This is Katie Ruther speaking with Jamie Hamilton on May 7th, 2020.
If we could start by you talking a little bit about what attracts you to agriculture and how you initially got into it, that'd be great.
Okay. So how I initially got into it was that I thought I was going to want to be a veterinarian. And my parents thought it was a good idea that, oh, you should go experience a farm a little bit and, you know, just see if large animal is something you want to do over a small animal. So that's when I went up to Dave's at the end of the West Road. And he basically, you know, said, yeah, love the help, you know, for the summer. And so I was going to be up there for a summer. And, you know, I wasn't even getting paid. It was just kind of a volunteer thing to experience it. And this is year 9, I think, that I've been involved up there. I'm not really involved in the dairy aspect of his, you know, I don't do anything for him specifically anymore, but I've still got my cows up there. So yeah, that was how I got involved. I mean, when I was younger, going to England and stuff in the summers, we always stayed on a farm. So I think the first time I drove a tractor, I was 7 or 8 years old and, you know, just loved it. Spent summers riding the combines over there. And, but also just being outside, you know, and outside every day. I mean, some days when it's negative 20 and you got to go feed cows, it's kind of not the greatest, but yeah, I mean, that's a huge aspect of it for me, is just being outside, being active too. 'Cause you know, I can't sit at a desk all day. I mean, if I had to, I guess I could, but I'd probably go stir crazy. Yeah. So that's a huge thing. You know, I could say I love providing food for people and I think it's neat, but honestly, my, like I said, my biggest attraction is being outside, being active. And also it's, every day is different too. You never do the same thing. I mean, even at the small scale I'm at right now, every day there's something different, whether it's, you know, a different meeting or planning for hay season right now, or, you know, if you go from fixing fence to feeding cows to then you vaccinate, you know, I mean, there's just everything that no 2 days are alike. So that's really, really nice too. You'd catch me saying that at the end of hay season after I've sat in a tractor for 3 months, but you know, it's definitely, I mean, I've always said that about Vermont. I love the fact that, you know, we have so many different seasons that are so diverse, because, you know, for me, it's been always hay season leads into hunting season, leads into sugaring season, leads into, you know, pretty much back into hay season. But yeah, there's just plenty of different things to do. So that's probably what attracts me to it the most.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I can definitely identify with a lot of things you said about being outdoors, especially, and the variety of things that you get to do.
Yeah.
So could you tell me a little bit about what you're doing now with your business? Yep.
Yeah, so right now I've got just under 30 head of cattle, and I'm in a building phase. I'm working on a deal to acquire a business down opposite the valley, down in Florence. And I'm gonna, if all goes to plan this fall, buy out about 50 pairs, which is 100 cattle, and then another 50 head of young stock. So kind of will be my starter herd, and I hope to build that up to about 150 cow calf pairs eventually. And this is obviously beef. So that's the direction I'm heading in, and everything is grass fed at the moment. I'm toying around with whether to be organic or not, mainly because the beef farm I worked on through college, which is the largest cow calf operation in the Northeast, they want to buy cattle from me, potentially, and they're organic certified, and they're also GAP4 certified, which is like an animal welfare regulation. It's a third party audited organization, and you have to adhere to fairly strict standards as far as you know, cow management and the amount of space each cow has and the amount of time they spend on pasture and that kind of stuff. That's kind of where I'm at now, is trying to figure out if that's, you know, if I can justify that, because there is extra cost definitely to being organic, and the GAP certification will come with extra cost too. So, so that's where I'm at right now, is trying to figure that out. Backtrack a little bit, I guess, to college and high school. I was raising registered pedigree dairy heifers, and just kind of doing that as a something on the side to make me some money, since I was still helping Dave out for basically next to nothing. And so I did that on the side, and then worked for this beef farm. And I basically gave that up because the dairy market crashed and no one wanted to spend, you know, high dollars on pedigrees. They just wanted whatever they could get a cheap cow for that would make milk. And, you know, I wasn't raising them for that. I was buying them for a lot more than that and trying to flip them, you know? So that's kind of why that ended. And, I opted the beef route just because the dairy industry right now is basically, I hate to say it's a lost cause, but I really think it is a lost cause right now. So yeah.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about this, but what are you envisioning for the future of your business? You talked a little bit about a number of cows and a bit about farming methods, whether you want to go organic or not. How much land is down in Florence?
So there's about 400 tillable acres right now that I'm going to use to start with. And I hope to acquire maybe eventually double that. The land's there. It's a question of who ends up using it. There isn't a lot of competition in that area. There's one dairy, which is actually Dave's herd of cows that he moved to Florence that this other guy is buying out. I don't envision it being a major issue down the road, but, you know, mainly because dairy has been slapped with quotas recently, so they can't really expand. And that may change down the road, but I don't foresee it changing before I get established enough. So there's about 400 tillable acres. I'm going to use another 100 acres up here in Chittenden, Bob and Bonnie Baird's land, for pasture most likely. May try and get some other land up here too for pasture. I guess in the end I'll probably, you know, my goal, I guess, would be up around 1,000 acres eventually, but I don't know how soon that'll happen. I think I kind of hope deep down that I reach a point where, you know, if the land's available, I can justify getting it because I've got a market for more beef. I mean, that would be the ideal scenario. There is, you know, only so much of that around here. It's not like out in Addison County where you can acquire, you know, a 500 acre chunk of land, you know, just because the next door farm sold out. That's not really an option here. So definitely being proactive about looking for land and staying on top of, you know, hearsay in town, if someone knows that some land is not being used anymore, or one of the old guys that puts up hay is retiring, you know, I try to jump on that and acquire as much of that as I can. You know, land is definitely your most valuable asset in farming, because everything else falls in behind it. I mean, you know, you got to take good care of your cattle. You got to manage everything well. You got to take good care of your equipment and have efficient equipment, but if you don't have land, you can't have any of it. So that's kind of where I'm at size wise. You know, the farm currently with what he's got, it has 70 cow calf pairs, and he, you know, he figures that he could probably handle more than that there if he managed. He's, you know, he's retirement age, he's kind of backed off his aggressive management techniques as far as the hayland and stuff, So he figures, you know, I can probably, you know, he had up to, I think, 120 pairs with the land he's got. But I think, you know, he said he was pretty stretched at that point. So I think probably somewhere in the middle with what's there, and then get to expand out from that.
Cool. So who would you say your target market would be?
So there's not really one answer to that. I guess one of the things that I honestly don't want out of this is I don't want to be in the position where I've got to give, you know, 10 people tours of my farm every day because they want to see where their beef comes from. I'm just not that kind of person. I don't have any desire to socialize at that level, mainly because I want to not be in a position where I need to go do something for the farm and then have to stay back. I mean, because there's certain things, hay being one of them, you know, calving being another, that when you've got to go, you've got to go. You can't wait on. And that's kind of the difference, I think, with, you know, like what Jenna and Jacob are doing over at Baird's, is that, you know, they've got just the sugaring to worry about, and they're wicked busy for, you know, 5 or 6 months out of the year getting ready for the actual sugaring season. But the rest of the time, they're focused on selling their products so they can justify giving the tours and, you know, being personable. And so I definitely want to get a retail market, and I've toyed around with the best way to do it, whether you sell, you know, by the half, you know, and basically sell beef shares, they call it. I think that's an easy way to generate, you know, certainly more money than you would selling wholesale, but also not have to, you know, give someone a half hour tour and then have them buy 2 pounds of burger, because at that point you haven't even paid for your labor costs, you know. So that's kind of a direction I'm heading in. I will package beef and sell. I want to develop my own label, but I'm hoping that that's more of a, you know, more of like a store restaurant type deal. Maybe not so much restaurants, would be more, you know, by the quarter, by the half probably, but definitely like a grocery store co-op kind of thing. Not big on going to farmers markets either. It's not what I want to do with my life. People say, oh, you're crazy. That's, you know, people make a ton of money at farmers markets. Well, yeah, they do. And down the road, if I'm big enough and I can hire someone to market for me, then yeah, they can sit down at a farmer's market and that'd be great. But, you know, I want to factor the other side of this whole thing is the maple sugaring. There's 15,000 taps down there that I want to, you know, get started on. And you're certainly not going to do both of those and market your products. So yeah. And then the wholesale market there, part of the reason this is an attractive move for me is there's basically a wholesale market that's already established that this guy's selling to. And it's a grass-fed market, so you're paid a premium. You're not fed organically, or you're not paid organically. So this market, if I was organic, I wouldn't gain anything from this particular market. And then the last thing that I'm in the midst, and actually going to be talking to a guy today later about, the beef farm that I worked on through college is interested in buying cattle, like I was mentioning earlier. So, if they may buy up to 50 head a year, so that, you know, that's a decent, reliable market, and that I definitely get the organic premium and that gap, you know, animal welfare premium too. So that would be, you know, if we could make a deal on that, that would be really, really helpful. And the other nice thing about that too is, he wants feeder cattle, so he finishes them actually on organic grain and you know, or grain, grass, corn mix over there. But the nice thing for me would be he just wants feeder cattle, so I would calve them out, and they, you know, raise the calves on their mothers, and then as soon as they're weaned, I send them over to him, so I'd have no you know, no liability of them as soon as they're weaned, and just get a check, which is nice. The check isn't as big as if you finished them all and, you know, sent them to the store. But when you figure out the extra costs and stuff, you know, down the road, if that is way more economical, I may drift that direction entirely. So yeah, so there's two or three different options market wise that I've kind of started toying with, and that'll expand down the road too, I think. Genetics or something else I've always been big into. I started to say earlier with the jerseys, you know, I was pretty meticulous on pedigrees, and definitely want to go that direction with beef. There's a surprising amount of money in selling seed stock to beef producers. The one issue being not so much in the Northeast. You know, I think down the road, if I really got into it, you'd probably see me sending cows out of state to be sold, because there isn't a demand for that here. But you get out into the Midwest and start looking at these guys, you know, having sales, and you know, you watch bulls sell for $15,000-$20,000, and it takes a long time to get there. But if I'm 22 now and I start building genetics, by the time I'm 50, I can sell a bull for $20,000. I'll be happy. So that's another avenue I'm going to pursue. But that's kind of the last, you know, that'll be the last thing to come, I think. Cause it's going to take quite a bit of investment to purchase those foundation genetics. And until I pay the herd of cows off and the equipment and stuff, it'd be hard to justify, you know, buying that, because you're not going to see a return on it for quite a while. So.
Cool. So throughout this whole process, what kinds of resources have you been seeking out to like figure things out and build your business plan, like in terms of, you know, reading and talking to people and from your own experiences working on farms, that kind of thing?
So specifically with the business plan, I've been working with the Intervale Center, Sam Smith, and he's been helpful as far as just outlining, you know, this is what you should be working on, this is where we need to be at by this date, and kind of acting more like a teacher, just giving me deadlines, which is good, because, you know, this time of year, you just get busy. And if I know I've got a meeting with him at X date, then I know I can have the stuff ready for him by that date. But otherwise, be like, I'll get to that next week, you know. So my boss at the beef farm has been really helpful, just as far as, you know, any kind of questions I have. And I got a whole, he's probably going to hate me after today. I got a whole pile of questions for him. But, you know, he's on all sorts of agricultural boards throughout the state, and he's chair of the Champlain Valley Farmers Coalition. So he's just so involved with it and just knows everything. You know, I honestly have done a lot of this kind of solo, just based on my experience. And, you know, I know what stuff costs roughly because I've been involved, you know, now long enough that, and kind of using the small scale I'm at now, you know, and extrapolating it to what I think I'll be at. So that's helpful. I read a lot of just articles, you know, extension articles and stuff like that. Mainly on, you know, the genetics and the management, pasture management. I mean, there's all sorts of resources out there. You go to any of the big universities and they all have, you know, any of the ag schools have big extension websites for dairy producers, beef producers, vegetable producers, you name it. So that's definitely helpful too. I mean, I got a couple binders here, and every time I, you know, see an article that's worth saving, I print it out, throw it in a plastic sleeve. So I got it for the future and save it on my computer too. But I know it may get lost in the computer. It won't get lost in the binder. So yeah, those resources are helpful too. That's honestly kind of the extent of it right now. I mean, the guy I'm buying the cows from will definitely be a resource to me. He'll help me through the transition process. He's, you know, said that he wants me to, you know, do it solo for sure. And, you know, wants to see me fail to a degree and, you know, fix my own mistakes. But at the same time, you know, if I'm going to do something that he's tried and really hasn't worked in the past, he's said he's going to tell me. So that's nice. before I drive myself into bankruptcy, I guess. Right. So that's, you know, that's another resource. And Me and my neighbors, you know, Dave's been a resource just as far as learning stuff, but like I don't, like I said, I don't really have much to do with that anymore. So I'm pretty much running solo. I mean, Bob Baird is another one who's been helpful. Just, he knows so many people because he's been involved for so long. And, you know, Bob's really done a lot for me, between, you know, letting me use the pastures and you know, Bob and Bonnie both. And then Bob, like I said, he just knows so many people. If I ask something, last night I had a question on cattle insurance, and I texted Bob, "Hey Bob, you know, who do you use for, or you know, who'd you used to use for that?" And building, you know, farm building insurance, and I got a list back from with like 3 or 4 different people. You know, I never would have found them, so that's helpful too, for sure.
Yeah, that's so great. I have so many questions. One, why beef? I'm sure it's kind of, you know, cows are related to the experiences that you've had and where you worked. And number two, how did you decide to stay in this area?
Yeah. Why beef? Because I knew I couldn't make it dairy farming. Honestly, that's probably reason number one. I was really dead set on milking cows. When I graduated high school, milk was $26, $27 a hundredweight. And 3 years into college, it was $16 a hundredweight. And you know, we lost, I can't remember how many farms, over 50 last year, in the state. And it's gotten progressively worse. And now, you know, coronavirus is kind of the nail in the coffin for a lot of them. So I came to the realization, and you know, through college, just working on multiple business models for different classes and trying to figure out how I can make it work, and I can't. It's, you know, the facilities are so expensive. I mean, you know, a milking parlor is hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you know, right there, that's one thing you don't need with a beef operation. I mean, a barn. I mean, my friends in college, their family just built a barn for 400 cows, and it cost them $7 million. So, you know, it's just not feasible. Can they make that work? Yes, because they're an established business. They've got another business on the side. You know, but could I go out and get a loan for land and buildings and cows and make any money? Absolutely not. So beef was attractive to me because I love cows, and it was the other logical choice. Kind of is the only other choice with cows. And basically, you know, I worked on this beef farm for 4 summers, kind of on and off through college, during the school year, just whenever they needed an extra hand. We always stay in touch. I mean, I talk to my boss over there every couple of weeks and keep up to date with what's going on over there, and keep him up to date with what's going on with me. So it's nice, you know, we have a good working relationship and a good friendship. And then I went out to Montana, and you know, that kind of sealed the deal for me last year. Worked on a large cow calf operation out there, and just realized that, you know, wow, you can have, you know, a ton of cattle, beef cattle, and have nowhere near the amount of labor involved as dairy. You know, with what I'm planning on doing, I know that down the road when I'm established, if I have one good reliable employee and I want to take off for 3-4 days or even a week or even 2, you know, he can feed cows. I mean, there are times of the year where with beef, you know, if you've got no other irons in the fire, that literally all you've got to do with beef cows is just feed them and make sure they stay healthy. You know, your busy seasons with beef are your spring and fall where you're calving. And then obviously, you know, you got to factor in bringing cows to market and that kind of thing. But dairy is twice a day, every single day, no relief at all. And that's fine if you're a 400 or 500 cow, 1,000 cow dairy where you've got 10, 15, 20, 30 people working for you. If you're a startup dairy with 60 or 70 cows, you can't afford anyone. It's just you. You're never going to leave the farm. I've watched it with my neighbor. I mean, he milks, you know, now he's up over 100, but he's a small farm, and that's all he's done twice a day since he was 18. So, you know, I have no problem with doing that if I knew that I was going to be able to expand and reach a point. You know, I got no problem doing that for 10 years if it means by the time I'm 30 or 35, if I'm going to have 300 or 400 cows and have 5 people working for me. But that's not the way it works. So yeah, that's why I chose beef. And as far as staying in the area, I don't know. It's just a nice place. I mean, I'm involved a lot in town too. I'm on the fire department. That's a good group of guys. You know, just, I don't know. I've never felt a need to go anywhere, I guess. I like the area. I like, you know, get along with most of the people. So that's, you know, that's nice. I mean, since I've started up at the farm, I feel like I know 3/4 of the town of Pittsford now just because of different connections. And, you know, you can drive down the road and, you know, from here to town, I may pass 4 or 5 cars and I know who they all are and you wave. And, you know, it's, I don't know, you just don't get that in a lot of places. I mean, when I was out west, you know, definitely the rural sense of it and, you know, you're just, it's a totally different world. You're out in the middle of nowhere. You know, you just feel so free out there, honestly. But at the same time, there's, you know, very little social interaction out there, because, you know, the ranch I was on was 1/2 hour from town, and town was, you know, very minimal number of people. And, do all the ranchers know each other? Yeah. But they may only see each other, you know, a couple times a year at auctions or at the sale barn or at the, you know, at the rodeo. Every town has their own rodeo, so everyone sees each other at the rodeo, but it's just a little bit more spread out than I guess I'd want. That being said, if someone handed me 1,000 cow operation out there, I'd be like, oh, yep, see you later. I'm going west, but land is also very expensive out there too. I mean, one of my attractions for staying in the Pittsford Florence area is that we've kind of run out of farms around here. You know, one time there used to be, we did the numbers on it one day. I was kind of chewing the fat with old timers. And at one time there were over a thousand cows milked in the valley from, you know, Proctor up through to Brandon. And now there's 150-ish. So there's a lot of land out there. A lot of it's been converted to wetlands, which is a real shame, but, you know, it's a pretty minimal competition area. You get up into Addison County and, you know, people chew their right finger off for another 200 acres of land. So, that's, you know, that's one of the things. You know, land down here to buy it is a lot cheaper than up there. You get into Franklin County and you think Addison's a bloodbath. You get into Franklin and it's just a whole nother level of, I mean, just the competition up there. And it's big farms, you know, they've got the money to play with, and that's, you know, a small farm sells out and you got 3 big farms that show up on the doorstep the next day and want to buy the land. So you don't have that around here right now, which is really nice. It makes it easier to get started.
Interesting. What values would you say you're building your business on?
Oh boy. Having a really high quality product is probably number one. You know, environmental stewardship is a big thing. There's no way around it now. You have to stay on top of it, from a perspective of, you know, the state is watching you pretty closely, watching farmers pretty closely. And although I think that, you know, they absolutely need to have regulations to manage nutrients and to be environmentally conscious. The people that make a lot of these regulations have never set foot on a farm before. and they often don't really know what they're talking about. That's a whole tangent I could go on, but I won't. Yeah. But yeah, core value wise, you know, that's a big one. I just want to, I've worked on a lot of farms that I feel do kind of a, you know, they don't reach their potential because they're so strung out, they're spread too thin. I really want to just be some kind of a place where people want to drive by and want to see, you know, where it looks neat, where it's picked up, buildings are kept up. You know, that, I mean, I want to get to that point eventually. That'll take time and resources, but yeah, the product thing is huge. I mean, with any business, you want a product that someone's going to come back and buy again and again and again. You know, it, I guess I, that's honestly probably my biggest fear is having, you know, a product and someone buys a steak and they think it's a little tough and they come back and tell you that, or they post a review and says, oh, you know, I've had better tasting meat before. And that's like, oh, that's, I'm sure it'll happen, but that'll be a gut punch, you know? And that's one of the things with grass-fed beef that, you know, I'm really hoping that I can work around is that, you know, the reality is grass-fed meat is harder to produce on a, I shouldn't say a quality level, but on a taste level, you know, cause you don't have the same marbling qualities in the meat and, the same flavor, as you do with a grain finished product. So, getting, you know, getting the message out there that being grass fed is environmentally conscious and, you know, it's not even that it's not better for the animals to just be grass fed. Honestly, people say that, if they aggressively finish animals with corn, yes, that's not necessarily healthy. If the animals were going to be alive for the long term, but the reality is, you know, a dairy or a beef cow is slaughtered at 18 months when they're in a feedlot situation. So, that's just the way the food production model works. But from a, you know, from a perspective of marketing, you gotta definitely gotta make it known to people that grass-fed is, you know, healthy and environmentally conscious and the cows live a good life before they go to slaughter. And, you know, I honestly never wanted to have to really push any of those. I always hoped I could be, you know, make it work conventionally and just do farm because that's what I like to do. But that's not the case.
So if you're based in this area, where would you be slaughtering your cows?
It's up in the air right now, but it'll be in one of a couple places locally. Ferrisburg's got a slaughterhouse. There's one over in Benson, one just across in New York. There's some other ones. The biggest thing is making sure, you know, they got to be a USDA certified slaughterhouse. Because slaughterhouses can operate, you know, if for say a family has a beef cow in the backyard that they want slaughtered, they can take that to a slaughterhouse and have them process it and get it back and it's stamped not for sale, and that's fine. But to sell your meat, you got to have a USDA certified slaughterhouse. So that's something I'm talking to my boss with today about who he thinks might be the best option. But it's, you know, closer to home, the better from a perspective of just getting the cows there, you know, time on the road, stress on the animal too. You know, if you can minimize stress trailering them for long distances, you're going to get a better meat, you know, better meat product. You want the adrenaline in their system to be at a minimum when you slaughter them, which is huge in slaughtering facilities now. You know, there's a lot of methods and protocols that go into slaughtering now, so the animals are under the least amount of stress possible, to help flavor for animal welfare, the whole nine yards.
Interesting. So you mentioned land before, but in addition to land, what would you say some of the other biggest barriers are for entry into farming for newer young farmers?
Cost of equipment is huge. You know, for me to buy a basic lineup of hay equipment, and when I say basic, I mean like more basic than what I'll buy, like basically junk equipment, used old equipment that may run, but you probably spend more time working on it. You know, you're going to spend probably close to $100,000 on that. To buy good equipment, you probably spend three or four times that, at least. And that's for a small herd. You know, you get into, you know, sizable scale. I mean, a brand new tractor, even a 100-horse tractor now, brand new, is going to cost you over $100,000. So that's huge. And it's very hard to justify unless you've got a really big scale or a really good market. You know, buying something brand new now. Cow cost is, you know, there's a lot of initial capital expense associated with cow costs. I mean, are cows wicked expensive right now? No, because the market's so bad. So in a lot of ways, it's a good time to get into it. But those are your huge costs outside of land and buildings. The nice thing with beef is that, you know, building wise, they're nowhere near the extensiveness as with a dairy facility. You know, my brood cows will be outside year round. And this is common practice across the country. Beef are a lot hardier than dairy cows. And they, you know, it doesn't bother them being out in the weather. Unless it's, you know, severe weather. So, you know, your goal is to have some kind of a place where they've at least got some kind of shelter, out of the elements. But compared to a dairy facility, it's pretty negligible. Yeah, those are, I mean, cost-wise, those are definitely the biggest. I would say equipment is number one. I mean, with what I'm figuring right now to start up, I'm going to spend, you know, it'll be over $100,000 on equipment. And that's doesn't include all the hay equipment. That's equipment I'm going to buy from the start. And I'm going to rent the hay equipment or buy the hay from this guy. We're trying to figure that out right now, but you know, that's just a truck and trailer. A couple feed carts to, you know, feed round bales to cows, a basic tractor, a 100-horse four-wheel drive tractor, a squeeze chute for handling the cattle when you got to vaccinate them and things like that, and a couple other, you know, smaller items, a four-wheeler for going around pastures, checking cows and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's not even a third of the equipment I'll end up acquiring eventually. So it's, you know, it's definitely costly, but you got to have it. You can't do it without it, unfortunately. So, you know, some people do buy all their feed. I personally will never strive to do that because it's such a headache getting the quality product you want, trying to find it, especially around here, honestly. A lot of kind of retired farmers that put up hay because it's there and it's probably not the greatest quality stuff. So you definitely need to put up your own feed if you're going to do something at any scale.
Yeah, I have talked to some other dairy farmers and other people who have cows, and some of them were certified organic, and they said some of the biggest problems they had with being organic was buying hay, organic hay for their cows. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people were either, they were making their own hay or they just weren't certified organic because partly because of that. Yeah. So that, yeah, that's interesting. So do you have like 20 more minutes?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay. So capital, do you mind if I ask where you're getting the capital for starting up your business?
Well, the plan right now is to use the FSA, Farm Service Agency. They've got some pretty good beginning farmer loan deals. They'll loan up to, I think, $400,000 for operating costs. So that's cattle, equipment, that kind of thing. You know, the situation I'm in, I'm actually not going to be applying for a mortgage right off the bat because I'm leasing the farm for now. And assuming this all works, my goal is to buy the place eventually, but that's a ways down the road. So FSA is a big one. VAC is another, Vermont Agricultural Credit Corporation. And then Yankee Farm Credit is a big time, you know, ag lender. Yankee's requirements are a little more strict. Not bad. They've still got some beginning farmer programs and stuff, but FSA is definitely, you know, they can give you a really low interest rate, especially for a beginning farmer. I think right now I looked on their website and their interest rate was like 1.75% right now, which is, you know, just crazy low. And part of that is due to the current happenings of the world. And the other part of it is, you know, they're trying to get farmers to spend money because a lot of these farmers are just picking up and calling it quits. So, so yeah, they're based in Middlebury, and I've had only one meeting with them. That was back in February, and that was just kind of to introduce myself and talk basically about what I wanted to do. And now I'm in the, you know, midst of the business plan and hoping by the end of the month to kind of have something to go up there and say, hey, you know, this is my rough draft. What do you think? What should I tweak? And then start working on it through the summer. So,
cool. What are your parents' thoughts about all of this?
They probably think I'm crazy, but they definitely support it. But yeah, deep down, I guarantee you, they probably think, "What is he thinking?" You know, you look at the amount of time and energy you got to put in. And certainly if you look at the cash, you know, at the cash on hand or the cash flow, for the first few years, you know, you could work probably at McDonald's and make the same amount of money. I mean, you're working for next to nothing, but you're building equity, you know, and in 5 years, hopefully I've built, you know, several hundred thousand dollars worth of equity in cows and equipment. So you got to look at it from that perspective, and you know, it's going to take a while for you to reach a point where, you have, you know, a decent cash position. That's just the way of the game. I'm more than likely gonna, you know, hopefully as soon as the sugaring thing takes off too, between the two businesses, I'll be, you know, able to just support myself with those two businesses. If I got to go work a third job, then I'll really start scratching my head, I guess. But certainly from the start here, I'll probably at least work part-time for that beef farm that I'm going to be hopefully in a business partnership with. just because, you know, that at least will cover living expenses. And then you kind of can just work on the business, and all that money that, or any money that you make, you can dump right back into the business to just speed up the startup. So yeah.
Cool. So now if we could just turn toward organic.
Yep.
That would be great. Both as a farmer and as a consumer, for you, what does organic mean?
Well, all right. So farmer wise, I'm not a fan. Why is that? It's the animal side of it that bugs me more than the crop side. But I guess I'll talk about the crop side first. So the beef farm I work on over in Sudbury, they're organic. They plant corn. just about 150 acres, and they feed it to the Finnish cattle through the year. And in order to plant that corn, it's clay ground, so it's hard ground to work. You have to go in and chisel plow it. Then you harrow it two or three times, depending on how dry the ground is and how well it breaks up. Then you have to spread chicken manure on it, because that's your organic fertilizer. Then you go back and you harrow that chicken manure in. And if it rains or the ground gets clumpy again, you may have to harrow it again. But then you have to go over it with a set of field finishers. Then you have to roll it. And then you plant it. And once you plant that corn, you've got to cultivate it two to three times, because that's your weed control. And then once you cultivate it two to three times, you finally can chop the corn off. And then, you know, after you chop the corn, you spread a cover crop for, you know, prevent runoff. So that's 12 to 13 passes across the field for one crop of corn. Now, conventional with the no-till method, where you do use a spray, but you basically make one trip over the field, and you basically go, I'm sorry, you make two trips. Your first trip is to plant, and you no-till plant with a no-till corn planter, and then your next trip is to spray, and you basically usually round up, spray off the crop, and then you're done with it until you harvest it. And yeah, there's, you know, you'll spread manure on it in the fall. You would spread manure on corn ground, organic corn ground too. So there's some more passes, but when you compare the two, the amount of fuel you use to produce an organic crop is, at least in my experience, vastly more. And I don't think, you know, which one's better, whether it's better to use a little bit of Roundup or a lot of diesel fuel, I don't know. But certainly consumers aren't educated that there's that much that goes into that. You know, all they think of is, oh, they used Roundup, they didn't use Roundup. So people, I mean, that's definitely a major thing that, you know, that I see in the organic, that it's definitely not a perfect system. From the cow side, organic is a lot more difficult to manage a healthy herd of cattle, in the sense that you can't use any antibiotics. And there's some things that happen to cows, like people, where an antibiotic is an easy fix. I mean, I had a infection in my foot a couple of years ago, and I forget what it's called. But anyways, it was an antibiotic, and 2 weeks later, good to go. And, you know, cattle can get same issues with their, you know, it's called hoof rot. And one shot of oxytetracycline antibiotic, and they recover. If they're organic, you can't do anything to them. There's nothing you can really do other than, you know, you can open, you know, if it's an abscess or something, you can open the foot up and get the abscess draining and flush it out, and maybe wrap it or put a, you know, put a block on their hoof to try and get the abscess elevated off the ground, whatever. But outside of that, you know, you kind of reach a point where you wait and it's like, oh, well, the hoof looks like it's about to fall off. So now we're forced to treat it with antibiotics from an ethical standpoint. But now that cow is no longer considered organic. So any of that investment you put into raising an organic cow just goes right out the window. And you sell that cow for a conventional beef price at the, you know, local commission sale barn. And it's the same thing like with the calves. If, you know, you have a sick calf that's got pneumonia or something like that, and you have to treat them, you know, you got two choices. You either let them die or you give them an antibiotic, in which case they'll never be considered organic again. So it's, for me, I guess, you know, if there was a regulated method where, you know, in an animal's life, if they were allowed, you know, a certain number of doses of antibiotics or something like that, because it doesn't matter if you use antibiotics or not, it's never going to show up in your meat. It doesn't, unless you send meat that's got antibiotics in it, and it's tested and caught by the USDA, and then you're basically out of business because, you know, it's a major no-no. But if you manage it right and you adhere to the withhold periods on the drugs, that antibiotic is not traceable in the meat. So from my perspective, it makes organic very aggravating. And it's, you know, it's the same in dairy with mastitis. It's a common issue, getting less and less common due to better management, which is good. But, you know, if you're organic, or, well, if you're conventional and you've got a mastitis case, there's various different drugs, and it's, you know, very effective, usually cures the cow. And it's, you know, involves dumping their milk for a period of days, depending on the drug, and then things resume to normal. If you're an organic dairy cow and you get mastitis, you kind of, the one remedy a lot of people use is this garlic based kind of mixture that's more often than not homemade. Sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. If it doesn't work, you're in that same point. Okay, do I treat the cow and have it conventional and sell it basically because it's no longer useful to me? Or do I let the cow die because the mastitis is going to go systemic? So I think the organic vision has honestly hurt the cow side of the business in that sense. Like I said, I'm on the land side of it. I'm not sure which is better. You know, certainly not spreading a lot of chemical fertilizers on your pastures and stuff like that is beneficial from an environmental standpoint. And so, you know, on that side of the organic, I see how it makes sense, but I just don't, I really struggle with it. And that's one of the things I'm struggling with now is, God, can I justify being organic and, you know, putting, you know, even if it's an extra $300 or $400 or $500 a cow that it costs to raise them organic, and then you count, okay, maybe I'm going to have 2 or 3 sick animals a year that are now going to be conventional. So, okay, you throw away that money. So does, you know, where does it line up? Where is it cost effective to be organic?
So would you say your main motivation then for becoming organic would be ability to market your product as organic and
absolutely
acquire the premium?
Yeah. I would not, you know, if it was a choice between being organic and being conventional and getting paid the same price, I'd pick conventional all day long because it's so much easier to manage. And like I said, the cow side of it's always just been my biggest thing.
How would you say, in your experience, other conventional farmers view organic farming?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say they're hostile towards it, but some of them definitely are. I think a lot of them think it's kind of a farce, and I would probably agree with them to a degree. I know several organic farmers. One guy in particular is known to have a magic cattle trailer, and that he buys conventional cows when they walk on, they're conventional, and when they walk off, they're magically organic. So there's that kind of a thing. I think if you really looked into the nitty gritty of every farming operation that was organic, the number who actually adhere to every single organic regulation probably is surprisingly small. Whether that's intentional or not, I don't know. Probably both. But yeah. And I think that's the common viewpoint from conventional farmers is like, okay, you know, we know who's organic and we know how they, you know, roughly how they manage their operation. And based on the way things are looking and the few things you see here and there, are they really organic or are they just organic? So I think that's probably a pretty common viewpoint. Then again, farms that are organic that do a really respectable job are well respected by conventional farmers, for sure. But there's a lot of that, I think, skepticism about how organic these organic farms really are.
Yeah, that's a good point for sure. And then sort of at the other end of things, I guess, especially in relation to like dairy and beef, how would you say consumers understand organic?
I guess I kind of touched on this with the, you know, right. The whole just misinterpretation of it. I think, you know, the way organic's marketed, it's marketed as a healthier product. Is that true? Maybe. Does it depend on the situation? Yes. So yeah, I think honestly, consumers are probably, you know, I think organic is fantasized a little bit. I don't think personally that over a long period of time, eating organic grass-fed beef versus eating beef that grazed on pasture that's not organic, is going to make a difference in my overall health. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. I don't know. I don't know the science behind it, but I personally don't think it will. That being said, you know, there's good organic management, there's bad organic management, and the same with conventional. Is there meat that you get that's conventional that probably was off pasture that's sprayed heavily with Roundup, you know, every year to kill weeds? Yeah, absolutely. Is that healthy? Maybe not. Is there organic meat out there that is fed lousy feed, you know, moldy feed, this, that, and the other? Yes. Do people know that? No, because it's organic, it's the best. You know, that's how it's marketed. So yeah, people got to see both sides of it, I think. And I don't think they do. I think very rarely do they ever see both sides of it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So I have two more questions if you have time.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if you could speak to the impact that you've seen COVID-19 having on the food and farming community.
From a dairy perspective, it's been catastrophic. You know, the middleman is shutting down. The farms are all still running full tilt. They have to. Cows don't take vacations. So yeah, I mean, from a dairy perspective, Agrimark, the local co-op that, you know, markets Cabot cheese, they've told all their producers to cut back by 6% on milk production. And there are penalties for, you know, on the pay price for making more milk. And then DFA, Dairy Farmers of America, they've told farms they need to make 15% less milk. So it's coming back and hitting the farmers because, you know, especially the cheese business right now with restaurants all being closed is taking a huge hit. So there's not the demand for the cheese out there. And then there's not, you know, with the plants closed because workers are infected and that kind of thing, there's not the ability to process that amount of milk. I know farms that have dumped milk in their manure pits because there's just no market for it right now. The beef side of things, you know, same thing on the major scale, you know, on the conventional scale, the big slaughterhouses out west being closed down. You're going to see beef shortages. Not because there's not enough beef out there, just because it's not making it from the farm to the plate. And that's a real problem for sure, because ultimately it doesn't affect, it affects the middleman, but ultimately it affects the farmers more than anyone, because they're the ones that always take the hit for the price. You know, the middleman always makes money. I don't care what anyone says. The middleman's always going to make money. They're going to price accordingly. The farmers are at, and it's kind of unique to farming. You know, any other business out there, you set your price for your product, and farmers are told what price they're getting paid for their product. And they don't get told that price until after they're they sell their product, which I don't think I'll ever understand, but that's the way it's always worked, and that's probably the way it will always work. That being said, on the small scale, you know, especially locally, local beef producers, sales have skyrocketed. And if people can keep up with demand around here, there is a ton of market for beef right now. I was listening in on another Zoom meeting last week with a UVM Extension, and one of the organizations that was selling beef just started selling online before this whole Corona thing. And they were selling like 60 or 70 orders a week. And now they're over 1300 orders a week, or something along those lines. So it's skyrocketed for them. How vigorous that market stays after this winds down, I don't know. I hope for my sake that it does. Cause I think that people will have a better realization that, okay, you know, this food came from just down the road versus this beef came from somewhere, may not even be in the United States. So I think that's good. I think it's been helpful from that perspective. The ag community at whole, I know just the beef industry in the US was projected to lose, I think, $13 billion or something from this, due to declining prices and whatever. But when people talk about the beef industry, they're talking about, you know, the conventional industry, what you see out west with the big feedlots and cow-calf operations and stuff. So when you look at it on a more local, smaller scale, I think COVID's actually helped some people, which is, hate to say it, that it takes that for people to realize where the food comes from, but it really does. So in that sense, I think being a small, you know, smaller local guy selling meat may be beneficial. But time will tell.
Yeah. And then my last question is just about what your hopes for the future of food production are.
I hope that, you know, people realize, get a better realization where the food comes from. I think there's a surprising number of people in the world that still think their food's made in a grocery store. And probably more people than I would care to think that beef and milk is probably made in a grocery store too. I mean, it's sad to say, but it is out there that, you know, there's just so many people, especially in bigger cities, that just have no clue where their food comes from. I think education and, you know, that side of it is going to be huge in the future. And I hope that we get back to more of a model where, you know, and I'm not bashing the big guys because, face it, I'd love to be a big guy. But I hope we get back to a model where people, you know, have a better idea of where their food comes from. You know, there's no need to have beef in the freezer or, you know, beef in the grocery store from Brazil when a guy, you know, four doors down has a herd of 150 beef cows. And that's actually a huge issue in the beef industry right now is we do import a lot of beef and, you know, our prices hurt because of it. And beef producers across the country are trying to get the government to realize that this is really stupid to import all this food that we really don't need because we import that beef and then we export our own. So, you know, how does this make any sense? And ultimately it's the middleman, you know, saying, well, I can make more money off this foreign beef than I can off the domestic beef. And that's, you know, when you're trying to keep farms in your country running and trying to support your own population with your own food, it's totally the wrong way of going about doing things. So yeah, so I guess my vision is I just hope that eventually people kind of get a better realization for where their food comes from. And also that they have, you know, I think a lot of people, specifically in certain areas of Vermont, namely Chittenden County, have this vision of farmers that is all they do is pollute our lake, and really the amount of energy and effort that we put into preserving the lake far outweighs the pollution, and it for me, it's, and this is kind of a specific instance, but you know, every time it rains, the city of Rutland and the city of Burlington dump millions of gallons worth of wastewater into the lake. And people seem oblivious to that, you know, but if one farmer, you know, happens to let a little bit of manure run down the road, you know, someone raises hell about it. So, people just, I think, are uneducated and like to point fingers, and I hope that down the road that changes.
Well, that was super interesting.
Thank you so much. Yeah, not a problem. Glad I could help.
Yeah, it was great to hear all about everything you've been doing and what you're envisioning for the future.
Yeah, well, it'll be a fun journey. I hope it's a long journey and not a short one, but we'll see. Like I said, I'm a parent, so I can always, you know, file for bankruptcy in 5 years and go back to school and get an engineering degree or something that'll actually make me some money. But I'll give it a try anyways and see what happens.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm very impressed.
Well, thank you. It's no different than anyone else pursuing their path, I guess. It's just the path I want to pursue. So
yeah, that's great. I'm super happy that you've decided to like take the plunge and that you're doing this.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jamie.